It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 579 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I have a great conversation with Benjamin Morse from We Are Scarlet Twilight. Ben writes, pencils, inks, and colors the entire series, and you can order the fourth and next in the initial series, or you can purchase the hardcover collection coming soon at zoop.gg. Here's the description. If you're a fan of Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon serials, the Fleischer Brothers Superman cartoons, Golden Age comics, or old-school horror and crime stories, We Are Scarlet Twilight is made for you. It's the next chapter of the thrilling cyberpulp adventure, along with the exclusive collection of all four epic issues into a deluxe hardcover with 20-plus pages of extra material. We discuss who the various characters are, as well as what the future holds for this engaging franchise. Don't miss this fun discussion and learn how you can join in as well. There's a lot to get through in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Benjamin W. Morse, the creator of a fascinating book called We Are Scarlet Twilight. And number four is now being made available through zoop.gg. And Ben, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good, good. It's good to talk with you. I did some research and I found out that I actually backed issues number one and two of We Are Scarlet Twilight when it was on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I recognize the name. Yeah. I appreciate it. Thank you.
I don't know why I didn't do number three. Maybe I was tight on money at that point, or I had enough comics. I always tell people I have a stack of comics that I need to be reading that are as tall as I am. So I have to hold off. So I can't buy as many. I buy a lot of digital stuff these days. So
I'm very digital as well. And my reading pile is bigger than I will ever catch up with. So I certainly won't hold that against you.
Okay. So it's the campaign is underway. In fact, as we're talking, you have already met your goal. Talk about that. Talk about what's going on with that.
We have met the goal. We met it pretty quickly, which I'm incredibly grateful for. We're coming up on what I kind of focus on is the number of supporters and backers, which we're at 240 right now. So we're sneaking up to 250. And my goal in starting this comic was that I felt that it was a kind of a niche comic in that you needed to know a lot about Golden Age comics, comics history, to kind of get a lot of the references that were being used here, the sort of mythology I'm tapping into. And I think that if you didn't know that, for instance, my dad was reading this, he would probably like it, but he wouldn't necessarily get like, oh, that's sort of like how old school Batman was or something like that. And so I felt like being a niche thing, I wanted to put it in Kickstarter and get it out to what I felt like was a selective audience of people that were into those kind of comics. And it went really well. And so I've always been really focused on how do I build my audience? Because I do a lot of different, I have a sci-fi comic called August that I'm working on and have published through Red 5. And in addition to Scarlet Twilight and a few other comics. And I kind of want to just get people interested in my comics and develop a relationship with the community out there, which has been a lot of fun. So that was among my goals with Scarlet Twilight, was to just get as big an audience as I could. So I tend to focus on backers. And I've been really grateful of the amount of backers I've gotten on Kickstarter. And then as we moved over to Zoop to help out with scheduling and getting the word out, and Zoop has been an incredible help in a lot of ways that I think we can get into. But people have followed me there as well. So I'm really grateful for that.
Because your original goal was 6,000, and we're of course recording before this actually posts, and you were heading towards twice that when we're going. By the time this posts, hopefully you'll be heading around for three times.
I hope so.
That'll be something great. Now, as I told you before, I'm a why guy. I want to know why things are the way they are. So the hero of the book is called Captain Lancet.
He is.
And so I had to look up what a lancet is, because I had heard. And when I looked it up, I was kind of interested as to why you named this character Captain Lancet. What happened with that? Why did that happen?
Well, that's a pretty good story, actually. So I had the idea for this story. It was a combination of a few different sort of mental pitches I had about what could be a good story. There was sort of a vampire cyberpunk idea I had, and I didn't think there was enough meat on the bone really for that to be a full story. And when I started to look at some old school comics, that I was like, hey, there's something there too. Those things began to coalesce and became what I thought was a complete story. And that was the genesis of We Are Scarlet Twilight. So I started to form this character, and I initially had I'm not sure if I should say his placeholder name, because it gives away a lot about his eventual character.
Okay.
But it was kind of a silly old school name. And when I sat down to really came up with his real name, I had a lot of trouble. It was a really difficult process. I ended up spending probably 5 or 6 hours on thesaurus.com. It had columns in Excel of usable names, usable adjectives. And what I came up with was obviously Captain Lancet. The thing that I really liked there was Captain is obviously a good old school name. You don't see a lot of characters with that are created now. I think that's unless they're throwbacks to this era. But Lancet, while it sounds exciting, it can be that there's a school where I grew up near that was called the Lancers, which is kind of a good name and sort of an aggressive action type thing. But a lancet specifically is, in addition to being kind of a spear-like device, a thing that's used to draw blood, which if you've read issue 1 or issue 2 or 3, you definitely know why that is relevant to Captain Lancet.
Right.
But it just sounds cool and action-oriented as well. You could almost think of him as a surgical tool as well. So you could say he's kind of Batman's been described many times as a surgeon to taking out crime. Right. So it works, I think, outside of some specific story elements you find in We Are Scarlet Twilight. But I think it also, once you get into the character and the story, it has a deeper meaning. So that's why I landed on that. But it was a very, very difficult process finally landing upon that.
Okay. Now, but you've also touched on the other thing that I'm interested in. You know, normally comics are named after the hero.
Yes.
But this comic is not. This is not called Captain Lancet. It's called We Are Scarlet Twilight. Why did you decide to name it that? Because if you read the book, you know what the Scarlet Twilight is. But I'm kind of interested that you went with a name of a group that is not the hero. So why did you go that route?
The main thing there was that I wanted something, and this is different than the process I kind of use in naming my hero, is that I wanted this story to be very clear about its intentions, especially on the first issue's Kickstarter. I knew that it was going to be difficult as an unknown creator to get people interested. I knew I needed a really good cover. I knew I needed a good idea. And I knew I needed a good title. And I knew I needed those things to all really clearly communicate what I was trying to do. So the cover was very retro, obviously a callback to a lot of 1930s elements in terms of its color, the references it makes, and how it shows the hero. The name and the typeface I use for the name, the design overall, I wanted to be somewhat modern and to kind of indicate that this is, yes, a Golden Age story. And I really try throughout the story to be very, very faithful to the Golden Age elements I'm using and to the principles that those stories kind of try to promote. But I also wanted to be clear that this was not necessarily just a recreation of that. So We Are Scarlet Twilight, to me, has a very modern ring to it. Yeah, there's a lot of comics coming out. I would say there's one called A Thing Called Truth. There's one like Last House on the Left. Things that are kind of statements, they sound a little bit like movies. And I wanted a title like that to indicate that this was something that was also a modern look at those things, while I do kind of try to uphold all the conventions and principles of those older comics. So the reason I picked that name was to make something that was a statement that was the title. And that's what went into that. It was a way to communicate, yes, there is some modernity to this comic as well.
That's interesting because the book is actually set in the 1930s originally, when it starts out. And, you know, today, most comics are in New York at the modern age. I mean, especially if you read Marvel. And I always get to the point where I'm dying. You know, New York City should have been rebuilt five times over. A lot of times it's been destroyed in the comics. And to me, I was interested to see something different, a different time period and what was going on. So you mentioned the heroes and stuff were back in the 30s, that a lot of these, the setup is back there. Was that why you chose that? Because it was consistent with the heroes?
It was consistent with the heroes. It was consistent with the comics I wanted to refer to. One of the things that really got me interested in doing this was, if you look at, there's a designer named Chip Kidd. He works with Alex Ross a lot, and he works with DC a lot and creates those books that are showcases of, you know, say Alex Ross's art or maybe 60s Batman art. And he does a great job of laying out old materials, merchandise, comic book pages with the photographer he uses. He sets that all up in a way. If you look at a layout from one of his books, that is great modern typesetting. It's beautiful stuff. And then it's also got beautiful pictures that also emphasize the oldness and the real beauty and the age quality of some of the old comics, the old merchandise of, say, an old Batman toy, an old Superman comic. And that dichotomy is dealt with in a way that makes both things really beautiful, really special. And it made me want to do something like this comic. That's one of the things that really crystallized the idea for me. So when I look at the era and what I wanted to do with it, I wanted to take a lot of the elements you find in Golden Age comics. And that goes to some of the lettering effects they use. That goes to how they approach the story, how they would say, how they would go from one scene to another and they would truncate some things. I wanted to use all of those elements and put them in a comic that still did seem kind of modern in some respects. And what I found, it was an interesting side effect, is a lot of those tools they used in the late 30s and the early 40s are amazing storytelling tools. They let you get to interesting parts of the story quicker, and not even as crude a tool as that, they let you pace the story exactly as you think it should be paced. So if there's something that's less a part of a story but needs to be covered, you have a lot of tools there to move past it clearly, but also quickly. And it lets you really control how many pages this scene gets, how many pages this plot point gets, and really get down laser focus on the important things that you want to communicate to your reader. And it let me design the series in a way that when I looked at the specific plot points and mysteries I was sort of putting out there in the book, I almost assembled this book. I kind of thought to myself, what is most pleasing for a reader to get? Like, when do I want to answer this question and start the next question? When would be the coolest place for this thing to be answered? So the reason I said it in that era was to use a lot of those tools.
Very good. Very good. Because now, one of the things in the description on Zoop, it brings up a point that you've just kind of touched on. It says that you write, pencil, ink, and color the entire series.
I do.
And I've listened to other interviews that you've done, and you talk about the fact that you consider yourself a cartoonist. And other people I hear use the term storyteller as opposed to a cartoonist. So what didn't you do in the book? I mean, you didn't print it, obviously. The printers had to do that.
No, everything that goes up to the printer, I do.
Really? Wow. So you create the digital format, because that's how printing goes these days. You have to send like PDFs and stuff like that. Wow. So you do the whole business.
Everything from story up to lettering to pre-press. And when it gets sent to the printer, that's where it leaves my hands.
Wow. It's because I deal with newspapers and print and other print things like that. So I'm seeing those kinds of very similar process. And to me, it's just interesting to see other people go through that and how you approach it. The thing I'm interested in is how did the because you're obviously written the story. Do you find the fact that you're working on the art and all the inks and the lettering and stuff like that, does that give you a chance? Like, let's say you got the book almost done and suddenly you go, I didn't want to say that right there. I wanted the character to say this, or I think it's better to say that. Can you make changes like that far in the process?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the great things that I'm very lucky to, you know, have learned those skill sets and people, you know, taught me those skill sets in my career. I'm really blessed to have that. I think that, so when I approach the story, I actually start in Microsoft Excel. I have scenes in mind. I kind of do a sum thing on one panel where I have the number of pages each scene gets, make sure it adds up to 22, and start mixing and matching things. Then I take it into InDesign. I do very rough dialogue and scene descriptions and panel layouts. And there I'm kind of, while I'm doing my rough dialogue, you know, I've already got it plotted out. I'm putting in rough dialogue and panel layouts, giving, you know, deciding what panel is going to be big, what's going to be an isolated panel, things like that. Then I draw it out. And sometimes I have the final dialogue very much in mind at that stage. Sometimes it's like almost placeholder dialogue that I really intend to change down the line. And so I do another pass as the art's completed and I'm lettering it to really refine the dialogue. Sometimes I'm happy with that. About half the time I am. And on this project specifically, I do another pass after that where I will go through some Golden Age comics I have in collections and try and pick up a little bit of lingo or sayings or way of doing things that fits the dialogue. And if I can replace something I have that I liked with something that is very, that's really cool that I saw that Robin said in 1940, I'll try and pick up on that. So that's my process. And I'm very lucky to be able to do that because I'm just one guy and I can do it. I don't have to email somebody and say, hey, I'm sorry to bug you again, but can you change this? So yes, I definitely go in at the last minute and change things. I'm going to change things probably before I send this to print the day before.
Okay, because you reminded me of something I wanted to tell you was that I was at a convention one time, and the guy that was in the booth next to us, he was a seller of 30s and 40s type comics, and he knew I'm a big Batman guy, and so he brought over to me a Batman comic from like 41 or 42, and I was terrified to touch it because, you know, it was older, and but I finally figured out how I could turn the pages and stuff without causing any damage, and so I started to read them, and the thing I was interested in is that there were, in that one issue, were four stories. Not just one, you know, because nowadays we get, if we're lucky, we get a story ending in 12 issues. But there were four stories in there, and I was really intrigued to look at it and see how it was done. Now, they packed a lot into those pages, and I think you follow the same pattern as far as making the, you know, every page has lots of good things going on. And so I really appreciate that as somebody who oftentimes can read like a book in less than 5 minutes. I can't do that with your book. I have to pay attention and go through it, which I really enjoy. So I wanted to tell you, that's one of the things I really appreciate about what you're doing.
Oh, that's nice to hear. And it's also very, very much something that's on my mind when I was putting it together, especially with issue one. I don't have a reputation. I haven't done a lot of books. I am an unknown quantity for, you know, 99% of the people that will come across this. So I knew that everything I put out there, especially with the preview pages or covers, has to be, there is no, oh, check out the next thing that makes this make sense, or the next page will be better. It's got to be good right then. So I've been very cognizant of that. I know that, especially with the first issue, and, you know, with every issue, really, I've got to make sure that this issue is a good experience. This issue was enough. This had a lot of questions answered, new questions raised, and kept the story moving, kept the momentum on the right pace, like a piece of music would kind of do. And yeah, that's absolutely something that's on my mind. I think that's a good, I'm grateful for that. Because I think that it's easy, probably, you know, when I read comics now that are, you know, from DC or Marvel, I like them a lot. I'm not going to, you know, knock on them necessarily, but there's a focus that's a little bit different when you have Spider-Man, when you have, you know, even Batman. People are going to keep buying Batman and Spider-Man. And I don't have that safety net beneath me. And I think that's a good thing. Nobody cares about Captain Lancet unless I make that issue really fun. And I make the next one really fun every page. So that's something that's been on my mind a lot as I you know, create the artwork. Also, even back in the planning stages, when I'm in Excel saying how much space should this scene get? How much space should that scene get? Is this going to be a slog to get through? If so, can I shorten it or do it in a different way? That's definitely, I have a really keen eye on the experience of reading this comic, every issue, every page. And I'm glad to hear that comes across.
Now, I want to talk about the art, because as I heard you say, once you are an artist first and the other stuff comes, it grows out of your being an artist.
It does, yeah.
And so the thing I'm interested in, where did his costume come from? Captain Lancet, is the symbol on the front of his costume? Well, where did it, obviously you designed all this. Is that based on some kind of logo or something?
Not a specific logo. It's an interesting story. I was designing his costume. I was going through a lot of Golden Age heroes and picking up every convention that I'd see over and over again, which is sometimes high collars, sometimes those sort of Jodhpur pilot pants. Just everything I'd see, I had it on a page. I had, 40 sketches of people, and started mixing and matching elements. Another thing I knew I wanted to bring in, I'm a big fan of Frank Lloyd Wright's patterning stuff. If you see on his windows, he's got these really cool designs. I wanted to use those or something like them in a part of Captain Lancet's uniform. It would maybe something on the rib cage or the shoulders that had a intricate pattern of that kind. And so I had that on my screen in one of my layers and had it set to multiply to overlay something, thinking I would kind of be have that as a texture to a color field on his uniform. I flipped that design for some reason and had it overlap. And it was like basically a mirrored image that was semi-overlapping, and it created something very much like his logo. And I saw that and I was like, oh my goodness, that's a cool image. I like that. Sort of came up with something that led to that shape. And that became the logo, the yellow logo that you see on his chest. And everything kind of grew out from there. It was very easy to design a costume that kind of orbited out from that logo. And if you said you missed issue 3, is that correct?
Well, I had, but they gave me a digital version of number 3. And I also saw the first 11 pages of number 4.
Okay. So you know what that logo then indicates as far as his past is concerned.
Right. But I was still curious as to how you developed the visual of it, because, so many times things influence other things. You see something. See, I would normally expect he's got an L on his chest or something. This does not look anything like an L. And so I was just like, where'd that come from? I understand that you're going to do stuff, but as far as the visual of it, it looked to me like a bird carrying something was the thing.
Oh, wow. I could see that. Yeah, absolutely.
So I was thinking, what's this got to do with a lancet? I'm a why guy. I'm always sitting there going, well, why does that? And why does that look like that with this and that? But to me, of course, this is the great thing about this podcast. I get to ask people all these questions I've been holding for so long. But I just was really curious, particularly about the logo. We'll talk about the rest of the costume, though, because it's largely black mixed with red and stuff. And the dark secret, which we will not discuss, has, I think, an influence on that.
It does, yeah.
Okay, so more than that, we won't say. But I like the costume. I tend to like darker costumes. As a big Batman fan, my favorite costume is the one that, not where he's wearing the blue and the gray, but it's where he's wearing the black. Mm-hmm. And the gray. That to me is my favorite Batman costume. And people always call me, oh no, the original Batman costume is blue. I said, well, yeah, that's because it's in a comic. But in real life, he would not wear blue running around in the dark like that. He'd stand out like a sore thumb. So I like the black. And that's what I like about the black on his. It gives him a chance to go around in the darkness and not be seen.
And he has reasons for staying in the shadows. Mm-hmm. That I think it's useful to him as a crime fighter and, for other reasons as well.
Now, do me a favor and talk about his gun.
Because go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to say even his gun goes through something of a transition in here. Talk about, again, we got to be careful not to reveal secrets, but it's really interesting because, of course, in that era, a lot of heroes carried guns and stuff, Batman being the exception. But a lot of people, like all these different space people, would have Adam Strange had a gun. Everybody else carried guns and so. So I'm just, there's a logical reason he does it that you explain in there. But how did you develop that? How did you decide that he needed to be carrying a gun?
It was very much a throwback. I think the guns are remarkable, or you know, ray guns or anything like that. I think it, if you look at those old school comics, it was very common to see characters having guns that would not 10 years later ever have a gun. You know, for Batman, obviously there are reasons for that. I think it placed it so much more in the period. You'd see it was just not weird or remarkable. Like if you see someone like the Punisher with a gun, that says a really certain thing, or even any superhero with a gun, someone like X-Men, for instance. You know, nowadays there's a very specific reason for that. The default is to not have a gun, or you know, and when I don't want to get too much into gun stuff, but like or a ray gun or anything like that. If that's part of a character's thing, there's a very specific reason for it to be there. In say 1940, that wasn't the case. It was almost a default to maybe have one, and that it was really born of that. It was a thing I used to put him very much in that period. And like to match a visual of someone like the Phantom, who had the two holsters and the two pistols, it let him strike those poses. It let him harken back to those things. So that was the reason I had it in the initial visual reason I had it. There are also obviously reasons in the story that he has for using those that I think let me pay off. And one of the few, you've referenced that I don't think of myself necessarily as a writer first. Mm-hmm. I haven't really had training in that. And I definitely don't think I'm that funny, but that was one of the few instances that I was able to inject what I think was a little bit of humor into the story through how he initially is using those weapons and how he comes to use them later on in the story.
Now, I in the first issue, I have to say, you pulled a fast one on me. There's a place about, 22 pages in where you make it seem like we have come to the end of the story.
Yeah.
We have not.
No.
All I can say. I was reading the thing, I'm going to the page, last night I turned the page, wait a minute, it's not over with. Oh, wait a minute. Because it I don't want to spoil it in some way. I've probably already said too much, but
I'm very comfortable with spoilers. I like to just tell people this might be a spoiler, but I don't mind spoilers personally when I'm consuming things. So you know, we can get into that. I certainly wouldn't be, you know, upset about it.
Well, obviously you did that on purpose. There's at the end of a page, there's a box that says, "And so the Scarlet Twilight cult is broken. Thanks to the efforts of Captain Lancet," and on and on it goes. "And keep your eyes peeled for new adventures next month." Turn the page. It's not over yet.
No, it is not.
I was shocked. I went, "Whoa." I said, "Wait a minute." I turned the page back in. I said, "Wait a minute. He did that on purpose. He made that look like the story was over." And I was, I like to be surprised. I love nothing better when people pull the carpet out from under me while I'm reading and go, "Wait a second, he made me think it was this and that's not." And so I really love that about that. I thought that was a wonderful bit of writing. You know, talk about being an artist first, but this is where you married the two together to really surprise the heck out of me. So I truly love that. And if you get to that part in the book, hopefully you'll appreciate that as much as I did. I love nothing better than being led down the primrose path and then just being shocked. And that's what this did to me. I really enjoyed that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that landed. If you look at the rest of the issue previous to that, there are a few points where I've thrown some surprises at you. And obviously that's fun to experience, I think, you know, when those happen. But the idea behind those was not just for them to happen and be fun. Oh, I didn't expect for this person not to be the villain and for that person to be the villain, or for, you know, Captain Lancet to be ultimately what he is. I kind of threw those out there also to be like, okay, I've gotten through the, here's the fun surprise stage. I want you to think that's over. And then there's another much bigger one. I was kind of building to that in what was a fun way.
Yeah. Believe me, that first issue, it set up a lot of interesting things that come in the later issues, which I was very, I love to be surprised. I so many times I pick up a comic and you've gotten the front cover is the last panel of the issue. And I'm like, ah, I know what's coming. It's going to end up there, and almost always does. So when you did that, what you did, the several things that you did, every time I kept saying, wait a second, that's not supposed to be what happened. There's, I don't want to spoil something. There's one thing where Captain Lancet is, shall we say, being overcome, and then he's not.
no, he was taking a dive. He was, and that's, I hope, something that as the story goes on becomes clear to people, that the main mystery I wanted to establish with him, as far as his character is concerned, is the mystery of, is he who he says he is? And I kind of want to introduce some doubt to that, or maybe there are other reasons he does what he does, or he says what he says. And I hope that at the end of issue 3, I resolve this, I think, pretty concretely. But, you know, I kind of want to explore why this person might do this, why he might be a good person, and why, even with these other things that are a part of his character, I wanted to maybe take some of those and explain why it could work that he would be a good hero. And I think that this is not something that I thought of initially when I started it. But looking back, it's a perfect fit, and I can see why it occurred to me. As I was writing his dialogue, Adam West's Batman came to mind, and it almost became the voice I heard in my head when I would write his dialogue. And I thought, that's the perfect thing. It's if you look at that series, there's a campiness to it, but there's also a real frankness to it on another level. I think if you look at the way he performed that character, my first exposure to it was in the 80s cartoons that were, I think, offsprings of Super Friends. And okay, he was still Batman's voice. Mm-hmm. And there were points in certain episodes. I think there was an episode where it was a backdoor pilot to what they hoped would be a Batman series, where he was fighting the Scarecrow and they revealed Batman's origin in that episode. I think Wonder Woman was coming in to help out. Mm-hmm. And I think in the contrivance of the story was he had been ambushed in Crime Alley by the Scarecrow, breathed fear gas and freaked out. And even Robin didn't know what was going on. And Batman was acting moody throughout the episode. Wonder Woman, for some reason, was visiting Wayne Manor. And Wonder Woman, Robin, and Alfred were huddling up saying, what's going on with Bruce? And Alfred's kind of squeamish and says, well, I don't know if he'd want me to tell you this. And then there's a sound from off screen. And Adam West's Batman is standing, he's Bruce Wayne, is standing in the corner saying, I'll tell you, chum. And there's a real steel to his voice. It's the Adam West Batman, but there is gravitas, there's seriousness and heroism to it. And I think that his performance as Batman is generally regarded as silly. And of course it is silly at times, but I think there is also a real earnest attempt to be heroic with it and have not necessarily, you know, nothing he's done as Batman was that serious, but I do think that he had a great range of silliness and earnestness. And it's no surprise when I look back that became kind of the voice of Captain Lancet to me. So I was really balancing a lot of things that Captain Lancet had going on, parts of his character that other people would be like, oh my gosh, you're that. And for him, it's no big deal. And he can explain why it's no big deal. He is, and I mean, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but he is, I think, definitely what he presents himself as and tries to be that. So that was kind of the reason I did those things. It was to give him a real balancing character, to play with the way other people see him, the way he sees himself, and how much resolve he has about that.
Because the episode you're talking about was in the Galactic Guardians, which was the last.
That's right.
Super Friends. My very favorite part of the whole Super Friends thing was that one of the deaths of Superman, where Firestorm thinks that he's killed Superman and stuff like that. Oh, I love the Galactic Guardians. Now, I've got to ask, because one of the things you're doing that's a little different as far as that era is you're setting up the opposite number to be a woman.
Yeah.
Satanica. And I find that interesting. Is that not one of your things to do to kind of update it to kind of a modern take, as opposed to, because in the old days, the female they would be like the Harley Quinn to the Joker or stuff like that. It's interesting to see you kind of elevate the female character to be one of the main baddies in the series. Was that why did you decide to go that route?
It was mostly misdirection, and not entirely. I think there were some really good villains. The Dragon Lady, which, of course, traffics in some stereotypes that we probably try to stay away from nowadays in Terry and the Pirates, was certainly on my mind as far as her final incarnation. The main reason, though, that I picked her was misdirection. She's initially presents herself, and I don't think this is a big spoiler. I almost present it in a way in the issue that you should know when you first meet her, like, oh, wow, that's going to be a, that's not what he thinks it is. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. But, you know, the misdirection or faux misdirection really is why I picked her to be the villain. She's sort of seems like the Lois Lane, Penny Parker from Sky Captain sort of character. And we kind of see that she's, you know, she's not. So that was probably the biggest reason. And then I found that she was someone that it was fun to design because I didn't have, I knew the role I wanted her to play, but I didn't really have a good sense of her character until I got to where I needed to establish it. So it was kind of fun to discover her, how she would dress, how she would make other people around her behave, how she would speak, because they were things that were, I almost set up a role for her that she needed to fulfill, and then got to kind of, in a weird way, discover how she would behave and navigate that as I had to establish it.
Now, I got to talk about the sidekick.
He's my favorite.
he makes me think of Doibie Dickles, if you've ever read
Oh, okay. Absolutely,
you know,
yeah.
Old Green Lantern, he was, you know. Now, today we could never have Doibie Dickles because speech impediments and things like that are not allowed. But I always liked Doibie Dickles because he could take everything that Green Lantern did in with a smile and not be worried about it. And he was kind of fun to hang around, you know, to be around with. The Maxi Militia is a wonderful concept of how does a sidekick decide if he wants to be around to help the hero as long as he can, a very inventive way to make that happen. So I thought that whole business was a great bit of fun. I really enjoyed that very much because I actually had to sit there and think, why didn't somebody else think of that before? That makes perfect sense.
I hope it did. I hope it was fun too. And I'm glad to hear it. It sounds like it was. It was something where I wanted a character who could see very much like you described Doibie Dickles, take in the most fantastic things and be like, deal with it with the gravity it deserved, but also just be like, okay, I'm going to do this now. He's kind of a point of view character in some ways. And he's also, someone who's going to move the plot forward in others. He's got a very, very good viewpoint, I think, on all these things that happen and tries to be, he was a guy that I had no problem imagining how he'd react to things. I knew exactly what he thought and said about things. He just is completely not shocked by anything and reacts to it in a way that fits his objective. So those scenes were fun to write because he had to do a lot of different things. And he's like, all right, well, I'm going to do this now and I'm going to figure it out and I've got time to do it. And this is going to, and that's when I've talked a little bit about comic book logic that, you know, he couldn't probably really do these things, but when you kind of look at comic book logic, if you give something a little bit of a point A and point B and cause and effect, and it sort of works. I think in that type of story, it does work. So I hope that he's one of the characters that I use to explain a lot of things and to connect a lot of plot points. And my intention with him was to make him fun enough so that those things are not just connective tissue or exposition, that I could, if I'm going to have exposition, I'm going to make it fun exposition. And I hope that it did those things.
It was wonderful because I always think that the quote unquote sidekicks are underestimated. Is that the way to say it? I think that because they're hanging around with somebody with powers and things like that, like a Green Lantern ring and stuff like that, they kind of are in the shadows. So he doesn't get to think of, Dwight B. Dickens doesn't get to save the day, you know, because Green Lantern is there just to solve every problem. But if they ever got the chance, I always like to think that these sidekick people would actually solve a lot of the problems that we don't think they would. So I always thought that Maxie was that. He was, they finally, we see a sidekick get the chance to save the day, and he does. And I thought that was a really wonderful bit for me. For me, it was very heartening to see that, because I just think we definitely don't give them the chance to shine. And I think you gave them the chance to do that. Although it doesn't resolve everything, but he solves a problem that needs to be solved. So I love that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's, it comes out of, like I said, I needed some things to happen in the story to make it make sense. And, you know, then I can kind of step back. And this is when I say I kind of assembled the story rather than wrote it in a lot of ways. I could look at those kind of scenes and be like, this is going to happen. It's kind of connective tissue, but like, what could be fun about this? Let's think of a way to make these 5 or 6 pages really fun and not just like, okay, you got to read this to get to the other part sort of a thing. And he was a great vehicle for that. He doesn't play a huge role in the conclusion, which I think, you know, if you've gotten to midway through issue 4,
right.
But he plays a pretty big role in what's going to be the sequel to Scarlet Twilight, which is going to be kind of my approach is going to be, it's sort of going to be if Crisis of Infinite Earths was written in 1940, how that might have unfolded and what sort of thing that might have been. And he'll play a much bigger role in that.
Oh, good. Because now I've got all kinds of questions I daren't ask.
I threw a lot at you there.
Well, I didn't. I want to read the end of the book before I get my answers.
I'm close to being done. I will send you a copy of PDF to review as soon as it's ready.
I'd love to. Questions I don't expect you to answer. Will Captain Lancet survive and go on to the next book? Will the Maxi Brigade group survive? How are these things? Who's going to make it and who's not? Kind of stuff. Like, I always, when I care, I guess that's a sign that I care about these characters, because I want to know, do they survive? Do they make, what will they do? Will they have a role in future stuff? So for me, I think it's really cool. It tells you that I'm invested. And speaking of invested, I've actually backed the hardcover. I'm going to have the hardcover
of this. Thank you.
So I backed that, and I didn't get number 4 because I figure I want to have the whole thing. There's certain stories I want to keep in my little library that I have here. And this is one of those ones I want to hang on to. I belong to a little group, and I don't know if I 100% buy into it, but it's, the name of the group is When DC Comics Were Fun.
Oh.
And I was interested because I was recently reading, Geoff Johns has come back and doing Justice Society stuff, but man, is that dark. You know, he did.
Yeah, it can be.
He did Justice Society of America, and it was great back in the day, but now...
Are we talking about the one that's on, say, issue 4 or 5 right now?
Yeah.
With Huntress as the main character.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And see, it's really dark, and I'm kind of... I see that Mr. Johns is going to be at MegaCon in Florida, which is near where I live, and I'm going to go up to him, and I'm going to say, why are you making it so dark all of a sudden? But the Justice Society of America books that you did, they weren't dark. They were actually quite fun. He did a Power Girl issue that I still laugh out loud about. But I don't understand why it has to be quite so dark all the time. But your book doesn't do that, thankfully.
Try not to.
It's a lot of fun. And there's Daring Do, Buckle That Swash. Lots of interesting things going on that makes me turn the page quickly to see what happens next. And I just really enjoy it. And I wish more books were like that, because we need to have fun with our adventure. We need to, we need to have danger, and we need to have problems that are beyond our mortal coil for other people to be able to solve. But I want to be able to enjoy the ride too. And I think that We Are Scarlet Twilight really does that so well. I was so grateful that I had all, I could read the as far as I could, because I really got to the place where I'm going, oh boy, Oh boy, now I really want to read the ending, because based on what I've read, I'm really looking forward to how you're going to tie all this together. And I don't think you're going to tie everything together, if I have a sense of how you're doing it, but you're going to do a great job of satisfying us with a really good ending.
There will be one question remaining at the end. Everything else will be answered. So I'll say that much about it. And I think that I'm really excited for people to read the ending. I think it worked out so much better than I had initially, when I was back in issue one, planned for it to be. So, and maybe that's me. I think, creators are probably not the best judges of our own work, but I'm really excited about it. So I hope you'll like it. And I think as far as what you're saying about the tone of it, that was something that was really important to me. I did want this to be an Errol Flynn type adventure, even though we do go to some places that are pretty dark. And I think I have a little bit of a cheat code in that so many comics now, especially ones that go back to retro things, the impulse is to be really deconstructionist about it. Oh, Adam Strange did these bad things and his wife is covering up for him. I mean, not to isolate that story, because there are some cool things about that mm-hmm. I really like. And there's great, I mean, even going back, like Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen were really awesome. And a lot mm-hmm. of stories that have dealt with those heroes in that way are really awesome. And not to knock on Tom King, because he's written some of the, like, oh my goodness, that Superman miniseries he wrote, Up in the Sky, is one of my favorite things ever. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean to knock on those things, but the reason I bring them up is I know that when I put this comic out there, that a lot of other comics are doing this to these type of heroes. So even if I'm playing it completely down the middle, I know that there's an impulse, or you'd have to think as a reader who's reading these other things, that there's a chance I'm going to veer off into, isn't he a bad guy, or he's just doing this to cover up this habit or this other thing, and be, like I said, kind of deconstructionist about it. So that's an advantage that I have in releasing this now, is the things I left said and unsaid, I know that are in people's heads because of the other comics that are coming out right now. But my big, something I guess, as far as my approach is concerned, is I always wanted him to be, even though there's doubt introduced as to if he is this person, a good hero, a good man. Mm-hmm. And to really be earnest about that, because that, if you look at those old comics, they can be dark in a lot of ways. There's gangsters, there's some pretty gruesome, deaths, Batman's shooting people, Superman's threatened to throw people off of buildings. It was a rough time as far as how these heroes behaved, but there was an earnestness and a goodness to it that I felt a responsibility to be true for. I would never do a Golden Age throwback story that's like, oh, isn't our man a drug addict or something like that? Because I guess it kind of is, and you could do that, and that's fine. I'm sure there's a good story to be told there, but that's not really where I live and breathe. I think, and I said this to someone the other day, I think if you do like these things, you want to see it be those things. You want to see truth, justice in the American way. And not all the time, not across the board, and not so much that it's saccharine, but that was definitely something I wanted to do. And I have the advantage of knowing that some people don't do that, and you might be expecting me not to do that. And I certainly play with that tension a lot. But I wanted him to be a good hero. I wanted the story to be a good adventure, bad villains, high stakes, and good swashbuckling, that sort of thing.
I'm looking forward to it. I think it's going to be great. I'm still sore at Mr. King about the Batman Catwoman wedding of sorts. I'm still mad. I don't know if you're familiar with all of that, but
pretty much. Not every issue, but
they
broad strokes.
They get up to where they're about to get married, and they turn around together at the same time and jump into the darkness instead of getting married. And I was like, wait a second. Wait a second. Because I've read Batman for so long, he's been my favorite. I would have loved to have seen him get married, because I think Superman getting married is one of the best things they ever did. Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to have seen Batman get married, because I haven't read that before. So I was anxious for that to happen. And when they didn't do it, I was like, wait a second. I was looking forward to that. So anyway, but your book, I think, is going to be, I hope it helps bring back a lot of that kind of storytelling and makes comics more that way, because I think we feel a shortage of that kind of storytelling that we need in the comics. I mean, it's the whole point of these kinds of books is to have fun and have an adventure. And that word adventure is something we don't get all that much. We get a lot of personal conflict. We get a lot of darkness and stuff like that. But I like to see a story that is, that word again, adventure, is to me, it has a lot of wonderful things in it. I think you have done the best job, and I hope reviving that word adventure. And we are Scarlet Twilight, and it's number 4 in the hardcover collection. If you go to zoop.gg/seasoncat/WeAreScarletTwilight4. And it's number 4, by the way. So you get there, and that'll help you do it. And congrats on getting your passing your goal so nice and quickly. And let's hope it just keeps getting better and better, because we need more of this kind of book. And I think, Ben, you're doing wonderful stuff, and I'm dying to see. I could go back and get that other book that you did. I got to go back and read that one now that I've been reading this one. Now I'm anxious to get to that one, too.
I hope so.
It's great stuff. So keep it up and much success. And I hope this is the beginning of the Scarlet Twilight verse of sorts.
Hope so, too. Thank you.
Kind of wonderful thing. So just keep it up and much success.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that it's hitting the points I wanted to.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast, so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this week. Be back next time. We'll have another great interview with another terrific comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
And so I leave, knowing that a world full of heroes has nothing to fear.